OneOfUs.net Podcast Network.
One of Us is a podcast and video network funded all but entirely by donations and subscriptions. We do accept pitches for audio-based or banner ads, but on a case-by-case basis. If you're interested in that, contact us at oneofusnet@gmail.com. With the amount of audio and video content we generate, it is expensive and extremely time-consuming to keep things running. Please go to the webpage oneofus.net and sign up for a subscription at $2, $5, $10, or $25 and get a ton of bonus content. One of Us needs and appreciates all your support. It does seem strange to me that it really took until now for Guillermo del Toro to make a movie about circus sideshow freaks. I mean, wow. It feels like his whole career has been about building up to this.
Everything he's done so normal up until now.
Jeez. I mean, now he's done this. Now all he has to do is a Lovecraft film and he can go, I'm done.
If only we do a Lovecraft film.
He keeps talking about it, so don't hold your breath.
He literally this week again brought it up in interviews saying like, no. The Mountains of Madness is still very high up on my to-do list, only now it doesn't have Tom Cruise and will probably not be as big of a production.
And he's talking to Netflix about it, apparently.
I certainly hope that since he doesn't want to use Tom Cruise, he's going to use Bradley Cooper, because by God, if I had known, unlike a lot of people, I'm not the biggest Del Toro fan in the world, but I think those two working together, that relationship,
that was good.
I think that's why I enjoyed this movie so much.
They were just so in sync together.
I felt kind of disappointed when DiCaprio dropped out. I thought, oh, Bradley Cooper, okay. Now I can't imagine anyone else being
Absolutely not. They were on the same wavelength all the way through, and it shows.
Oh, most certainly. Yeah, 100%. I mean, because Nightmare Alley, which is, of course, another take on the 1946 novel of the same name by William Lindsay Gresham, but is famously, although not when it first came out, it took reconsideration later, a 1947 film with Tyrone Power that was directed by Edmund Golding. It is one of the darkest, most fucked up noirs ever, but the lead character, he's so good looking, you kind of want to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Right, and that's the secret to his power.
Yeah, exactly.
Pun intended.
Yeah, Bradley Cooper seems like exactly the right guy for this part, because he is that guy.
It wouldn't have worked with DiCaprio, I don't think. I think Bradley Cooper is just so, like, godlike looking in a way.
For one thing, like, I'm sorry, I like The Aviator, but Leonardo DiCaprio cannot carry off the pencil mustache. Like,
no,
he was being rocked in this movie.
He forever looks like a cherub, in a way, you know?
It's been a long time coming, him doing this. This is another one of those films that's been on Del Toro's I'm gonna do this list for a very long time, where Del Toro is one of those directors who famously says, I'm gonna do this, and then you're like, okay, like 10% of the things you say that about
waiting for that Hobbit movie, dude.
But it's not for lack of, like, trying or wanting or shopping it around, I'm sure, but
yeah. I mean, this original film was really kind of looked down on when it first came out, because it was too dark, even for film noir. People were like, this is a fucked up movie.
It was daring to get that done.
The novel is far, far darker. Yeah. I mean, they toned a lot down. My interest in this movie was, how are they going to capture it? What's Del Toro going to do? Because he doesn't have the same limitations that Golding and Power had to deal with back in the day. And he still tones it down. Ooh. I mean, that just tells you how turgid and sordid the Gresham novel really is.
Absolutely. Well, Power, at the point where he filmed that, and it opened people's eyes to his acting ability, if nothing else, but he was known for doing swashbucklers. He was most known for playing Zorro and doing a damn fine job of doing it, but he was kind of more of a swashbuckling hero like Errol Flynn, whereas Bradley Cooper may have started out as
being the hangover guy.
But now we've seen him, like, piss himself on the Grammy stage, and so we can kind of accept that this guy has seen some dark shit.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it also the only reason that we have the original version of this novel is because of Tyrone Power's clout?
Yeah, in a way. That's correct. Absolutely. He fought for it. He got it. He insisted the studio buy it. He'd been in World War II. He'd seen some shit. Yeah. He wanted to change his image. He wanted to do some more serious stuff, show off his chops, which he had. He'd mostly been spinning his wheels in romantic comedy or swashbucklers. It flopped hard, and I'm sure Daryl Zanuck never ever told him the words, I told you so, but I'm sure every time they crossed in the commissary, he was thinking, I told you so. I told you that was a terrible idea.
Yeah.
if you get a chance, you should totally watch the original. Criterion recently did a release of it. It's tremendously well done. Tarot cards play a big part of the story, and they actually included the relevant tarot cards.
Aren't they great? Like, yeah.
I was like, that's a cool physical extra. Yeah. But we're talking about the new Guillermo del Toro directed version of this. I'm Chris, and joining me are...
Hello, my name is Frank, and I'm in between a dream and a nightmare right now.
I'm Marco, but I digress.
I'm Bo, and I haven't hit the level of a circus geek, but I probably will.
Oh, he's Bo, and he's regressed.
I think I got a chicken around here somewhere.
Monkey ate it. So
I can eat one of the cats.
Yeah, well, let's not go there.
This is from the day when geek meant something very different.
If you just give me a hot meal, coffee, and a shot with a little tincture of opium in it, maybe that cat.
When I first met Bo, he's like, oh, I'm a big geek. I had no idea that we were not talking the same language. Yeah, for sure.
That he bit off the head of Chris's first cat. We still don't talk about it.
Let's talk about what this movie is about for those of you who, which I suspect are most people, have not seen the original and don't really know what this is about. And for that, I'm going to turn to Bo, because otherwise he's just going to take over anyway.
Yeah, so this is the story of a guy who's kind of down and out. He's a drifter. He drifts his way into a carnival, a carny sideshow of the period, which is the 30s and 40s. He kind of ensconces himself in there, and eventually he ends up being the shill for a magic act, and in this it's played by Toni Collette and David Strathairn. They give you an idea that they used to be very big, and they used to have this very specific mentalist act bordering on spiritualism that they had really gimmicked out, so that she was giving him vocal clues and every specific word meant a specific thing, and so he could quote unquote tell things about a person by what she was saying. So it's just like, you have a gold watch and it's very worn, it's got an inscription on the back, and at some point they started to kind of flirt with spiritualism, and he had a bad reaction to this and became an alcoholic. And Cooper kind of sees this and kind of pounces on it as like, well, maybe this is my ticket to something bigger.
Yeah, it's a system.
Yeah, he's figured out a gimmick. And as we find out later in the movie, he's just like, I'm a grifter. I've always been a grifter. I'm a hustler. That's what I do. But also along the same time, he finds himself kind of falling in love with this beautiful young woman, Rooney Mara, who is
a performance artist, I suppose.
She has an act of herself that deals with electricity. She's a daughter in all but name to Ron Perlman's character, who's the strong man. At one point, Perlman goes to his character and he's just like, hey, I may be old, but I can still beat the living shit out of you, and I will if you keep fucking with her. I know that you're trying to nail her, and that isn't going to happen.
We did a long interview with him, and yes, he is actually kind of scary in real life.
How tall is he in real life?
He's really tall.
He's really tall, and yeah, if you ever have a chance to listen to his interview on Mark Maron, he is a very intense dude.
Very, very nice, to be clear.
But yes, cool. Sweet as the day is long, but yeah, you probably don't want to be on the right side of his fist. At one point, David Strathairn's character is having Bradley Cooper's character fetch him alcohol, which has kind of been set up by Willem Dafoe, who is more or less bossing the geek exhibition. And the geek, for those of you who are not familiar with the original term, is a circus performer who's kind of this wild man who bites the heads off chickens and sucks out their blood. And generally in real life, they're like hard luck drunks that have gotten to a point where they're willing to do anything for...
They're on their last leg.
They're on their last legs. And so they're willing to bite the head off chicken for a drink.
So it is you.
Yeah, exactly. And Defoe's character is also in charge of kind of the alcohol. The performers rely on him for sugarcane spirits.
Sugarcane spirits,
he has that, and he also has wood alcohol, which he uses to preserve weird fetal pig kind of things that he passes off as freak show exhibits.
But Cooper doesn't really want to be there or be stuck at the circus for too long. He's looking for his opportunity. He's into Rooney Mara's character, and he gets his opportunity when he decides he's going to take the act of David Strathairn and bring it and her to the big time.
And then we go to Hollywood glam mode. They have taken the act.
2 years later.
2 years later. They have taken the act. They become wildly successful. Everybody is dressed in 1940s clothing porn, tuxes, and the most incredible Art Deco sets that I have seen in a long time. He meets another character, played by Cate Blanchett, who is a psychiatrist. She tries to expose him as a fraud, and he turns it back on her and pulls it out and embarrasses her very much. But the person that she is table with, she like says he really wants to have a reading by you, and his wife is like, look, we don't get into this. This is not what we do. You know, the spook show.
Because he wants like, a spiritualist reading.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. that is considered by at least this group of carny folk to be...
A step too far.
It is their coda, in a way. It's their...
There's a difference between taking nickels and dimes from some rubes by just telling them what they want to hear and giving people these false hopes and convincing them that they're communing with the spirits of their loved ones. And when a carny thinks you're morally questionable, you should probably listen.
But that's also the most interesting aspect, that they do have that line that they separate. And I find that really just fascinating, because in that world, you think that there's no scruples anywhere. Like, no, you don't go there.
Yeah, despite the fact that William Dafoe's whole take on like how you train a geek is... horrifyingly
immoral. It's so dehumanizing.
Yeah, and this, at least for the people that he more gets along with, they say, don't do the spooky stuff. And there's an aspect in both versions of the film that, like, the tarot cards actually are a part where Toni Collette reads the cards and insinuates that there's actually something to this. The idea of, like, you're making a huge mistake if you start trying to do things with spirits. It never goes so far as to getting into ghosts or what have you. But the movie sets its tone very clearly early on that this is a moral turn that, yes, maybe financially lucrative, but it's going to fuck you.
The movie establishes this line very clearly, and then it establishes also very clearly that Bradley Cooper is completely incapable of seeing this line, and he strides right across it because he sees the opportunity, like, yeah, we're doing well, but we could be on easy street, we can make a financial empire with this, we would be idiots to pass this up. And so he gives in and starts conspiring with Cate Blanchett's character, the person that she brought to the dinner where she is. The tables turned on her. Bradley Cooper decides to help him out, as it were.
Suffice it to say, this is decidedly a film noir.
Yes.
And things, as they always do in film noir, except for maybe Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, don't go good for the characters involved. There are so many things here that both are a direct take on the original, where I'm like, oh, this is a very honest, loyal look at the version of the original, and stuff that is new to this, but maybe not new to the book. I know, Marco, you read the book. I have not. There's a lot more stuff about Bradley Cooper and his past in here than there is in the original version. And that ties a lot into the relationship with him and the therapist, who's basically Joan Crawford, played by Cate Blanchett. I mean, she's the severe Crawfordish, or maybe even Betty Davis type character.
I think she's more Veronica Lake-ish in a way.
Or her hair is Veronica Lake.
Well, she's so steely and icy and just so calculating in a way that's so hard to master, but she does it so well. Like, you just know there's nothing good will ever come from being with this woman.
Yeah. I don't recall the name of the actress who played that character of Lilith in the original film.
I don't
film.
Either. Yeah. Ellen Walsh.
She's incredible.
She was great.
And I will say this, having read the book and having seen both film adaptations, all of them are different. All of them are actually pretty loyal to the source, but all of them make changes, especially regarding the prior history, let's say, of Stanton Carlyle for his act. But the character of Lilith is one of the greatest film noir characters, actress in the original version, I have to admit, look, I love all of you guys, but I would kill all of you for Cate Blanchett if she told me to. But as great as she is, the actress in the original film, everything with Lilith, everything regarding that character is pretty much done better.
I don't want to say because it's Cate Blanchett, but I totally agree with you.
She's the holy ground that we don't want to tread upon, but I tend to agree.
It's a different
That being
take.
Said, I would take. I it would is. Murder everybody in the town of Austin if I could just own Cate Blanchett's character's office from this fight. Oh,
incredible,
my God. It is just this Art Deco wet dream.
That's a condo. It's not an office.
I was sitting next to Bo in the theater. When they go in, he audibly gasps.
Yeah. But I just saw the door.
Well,
I was
also
like...
Bo, I saw Bo like do that thing in the theaters, which you know you're really into it when you just like lean forward and just stay leaning forward for like a large part of it. And that was Bo dream most
always
of it.
That's always that point where you realize Bo really likes this movie.
Yeah.
She's a psychoanalyst. She's respected. She has a high-class clientele. He's a carny who's kind of worked his way up into a mentalist act with a veneer of class. and now he's starting to move into the spiritualist realm. But they both acknowledge one another as kind of grifters. They're like, we both know what we're doing.
We're taking
advantage of people. And as she says, you find out what their pain is and sell it back.
The whole
time
they're trying kind of like in just conversation, they're grifting each other unsuccessfully because they're both too good at this.
They are.
They're both too good at reading people. And so they're just sort of, it's this constant fainting sword fighting match between the two of them with personalities. That's just fascinating. And I think the high point of the film is the two of them are on screen.
Their scenes are largely just dialogue driven, but they are the most compelling of the entire film regardless. And there's a lot of stuff that happens in this film. But it's such a great dance that they do, the two of them. And because they are so perfectly matched, and she's such a great femme fatale because she's got a level of power that goes beyond just sensuality and, you know, this sort of beguiling. Yeah. She knows how to play with people. Yeah. And that makes her just one of the most dangerous femme fatales.
This is the Cate Blanchett that took the One Ring.
There you go. You were sitting on that one, weren't you?
I was sitting on that one.
In place of a psychiatrist, you would have a queen. Dark and terrible as the sea.
But Del Toro is, in many ways, as he usually is, the star of his own show. I mean, his style is distinctive. He definitely plays up the sort of fable aspects of this, the moralistic fable, more so than I feel like the original does, which is definitely more of a traditional film noir in some ways. And this is very much a Del Toro moral fable.
Yeah.
In some ways simplifying it, in other ways making it more complex, especially with, like I said, those aspects of Bradley Cooper, as we start to know more about who that person is in this version than we do about Tyrone Power in the original, with his relationship with his father, which is constantly teased throughout the movie, both in an opening scene and then with nightmares he's having about like what happened with him, something with fire
and a
corpse. So you're like, okay, some bad shit went down there. And Del Toro teases out in just the right way that although we already know, you don't feel that moment of Scrooge looking at his own tombstone until they show it. You know, you're like, oh, that final thud.
Literally the first image of this movie. And I'm like, well, that's different from the book and the original. Okay. Once he hit me with that, I was like, I have to let go of a lot of my preconceived notions, because right from the get-go, he's saying, I'm doing something different.
Yeah.
I'm using that structure. And Del Toro has said publicly that he's adapting the novel. Mm-hmm. He's not remaking the movie. However, he is not the first filmmaker to try to get out of this particular maze. And some of those previous people left some breadcrumbs, and he's followed them.
It's hard
to his benefit, because there's decisions made in the original movie version that compress things and simplify things. And I think he said, you know, that worked. I don't need to reinvent the wheel here. That was a good, clever solution to something that was a lot more complicated in the book.
It's so hard to let go and separate yourself when you have such an attachment, like as I do, to the remake. I've not read the novel. I would love to read the novel. But I think what he does here is so strong. His interpretation is so strong, and his grasp on the material and his devotion to it. You just have no choice but to embrace it.
And it's filled with color filtered through his normal faint sepia tint that he tends to use. It's like he either goes sepia or blue, and here it's kind of more of a faint sepia.
Though it was really lush. That being said, you know, this movie has a dividing line as far as, you know, the stuff that happens in the carnival world and the stuff that happens in this very glamorous, like, you know, high society world. They're very distinctly lit so that you can tell even when you're not like, oh, well, we're in a tent. You know, there's the second half of this movie feels like straight out of silver screen Hollywood, except that it's in color and it's lush.
Yeah.
And the first half of this movie is a fucking Tom Waits song brought to life.
Oh, it totally
Tom Waits is the only person who didn't show up in this.
They filmed Swordfish Trombones.
Right. Well, we had Ron Perlman and Tom Waits.
You want to know how you get a gig? Here's what you do.
It definitely feels like if William Dafoe hadn't said no, Tom Waits was next on the show. It should have been.
It is the best Tom Waits video that was never made.
Yeah, and that whole first half of the film, it's steeped in the images of the time, and I like that. There's actually some moments of light and fun during that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
It gets you to where you're kind of on Bradley Cooper's side. Like, even when he commits an act that you go, well, it seems like he didn't mean to do that. That is the big moral crux for him. And this movie plays more into the whole uncertainty of that than the original film.
And that first half is like, it's dead ass set in the Depression.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whereas the second half feels more like we're on the road to recovery.
And
Hitler
invades Poland.
It's so well timed in that, like, when things really start to come to a crux in this movie, it's like Japan just bombed Pearl Harbor. We're at war.
I did want to say, though, in terms of that first half, there's a scene where, like, and no one has completely gotten to the point where they trust Bradley Cooper yet in the circus. There are people there who like him more than others, but everyone's a little standoffish. But then he has a thing where the cops come to bust it up, you know, on moral reasons, mm-hmm. led by the great Jim Beaver, who's becoming one of the new, who is that guy character actors, because he's always great when he's in stuff. And Bradley Cooper, using what he's learned from David Strathairn, is like, oh, learns how to read him and pretend that, like, he's having second sight thing to get on this guy's good side and help everybody. And then everyone's like, oh, good job. And it's a genuinely laugh out loud funny scene, because you know what's happening, but it also serves the purpose of going, this guy's no dummy. He has picked this stuff up and he is good at this.
It is like a skill.
I mean, it's cold reading. I think the scene really is a key moment in this movie, because it even more so makes you go, I kind of like Bradley Cooper, despite the fact that, like, no question, he is a grifter, but he's a grifter you're kind of on his side for. And as the movie goes into the second half and he starts falling into the trap of going more, you're still going, come on, man, no, don't do it. And that's the key to this working.
Yeah, I mean, he always has that moment when he could just walk away, but he is one of those guys who is just so grasping and ambitious that even when he's got a good thing, he feels compelled to take it to the next level. And he suffers from that disease where you're convinced you're smarter than everybody else, everyone mm-hmm. else in the world.
Absolutely.
And this comes back right from the novel, which is very amoral, very bitter, very cynical. Everyone in this world is a mark. Everyone in this world is a rube, someone you can exploit. And if you're not exploiting them, then you're an idiot.
Yeah, you're
and
the
Bradley
one being
Cooper
exploited.
Thinks he's smarter than everybody else. And usually he is, but you know what they say about hubris.
Yeah. Well, he's an Okie with straight teeth, as the movie says.
Is that a great line?
great line.
My gosh.
But we need to go to final thoughts. So let's get started with Frank.
I was really looking forward to this. I think that the original, as a film noir, was quite bold and quite daring. And even just the introduction of the geek in 1947. I thought that was so bold and daring. And even today, that feels so bold and daring in a lot of ways. I'm glad Del Toro was able to see this through. This is one of those that was shut midway through because of the pandemic and picked right back up late last year. This was everything I wanted it to be. It was so lush. And I've always loved when dark stuff happens in really beautiful settings. I think that is so interesting to watch cinematically. And this film is rich with beautiful cinematography, production design, and just the most, not depraved, but dark actions taking place. Its noir ancestry is still intact and it's kept all the way through. And it's still a strong story because it keeps that there. The themes are just as potent, just as rich, you know, the need to want to believe in these confidence games and the need to prey on people's trust. You know, everything here is so practical. All the crimes are so practical. There's nothing like fantastic about it, but there is that overall theme of fate and destiny that's guiding each of these characters, especially Bradley Cooper. I love that dichotomy of this noirish crime taking place, but this higher power of fate moving all these pieces. This is one of the best of the year as far as I'm concerned. I don't have anything that I wish I would have seen more or less of. This is pretty damn perfect as far as I'm concerned. So I'm going to give this 10 out of 10 frustrated looks from Toni Collette when she's in the middle of her act and her partner isn't coming through and she's just got to wing it, because sometimes we just got to wing it, man.
Stupid David Strathairn.
Yeah, exactly.
Marco?
Having seen every iteration of this now, I love this story. Each version has its merits. Each does something a little different. There are key moments that you go, oh, that's exactly from this. That's exactly from that. So I got a lot of what I wanted. I really would have loved to have seen Del Toro tackle spiritualism and the medium racket, because that is wonderfully researched and portrayed in the book. But he doesn't do that. He's got to tell a story. I get it. What all of these versions have is a very strong ending that they build towards. That final image, that final moment,
yes,
is what is powering everything. They know what the end point is. And the original movie famously watered that down. But here he sticks the landing. You go, yes, this is what it's been building to this moment. And it's fantastic. Does this surpass the original? No, I don't think so. I think I still prefer the previous version. However, that's a movie that stood the test of time for almost 75 years. We've got some more time to live with this one. I will definitely watch it again. And I don't think that Del Toro has made something better or lesser than the original film or the novel, but I think he's made a great companion piece. One of these days, when you have an opportunity, I recommend you read the book and watch both versions back to back, because it's just a great way to see how three great storytellers tackle the same story. I'm glad all of these versions exist, and I was very happy to see this one. I'm going to give this 9 out of 10 rigged electric chair props that were improbably made very quickly.
They need to pull with dramatic, you know, tension.
No, that's bullshit.
Yeah, come on, Mark. All you need is a glue gun.
Bo?
I'm not the biggest Del Toro fan in the world, and I was kind of dreading this a bit because I'm a very big fan of the source materials. I love the movie, but I really, really enjoyed this. I was kind of on the edge as to whether I was going to, but they really stuck to the correct tones. It is dark. Like many noirs, this is not something you're going to watch to feel good. This is something that you're going into to kind of explore the darker corners of the human experience. And it's really done well, and it's really done beautifully. This movie is a really good combination of Guillermo's strengths as a visual storyteller. If I had known that this collaboration would have yielded such a great fruit, I would have gotten Guillermo del Toro a Bradley Cooper to play with a long time ago, because I think the two of them, they've admitted that this was very collaborative between them, as, you know, obviously Bradley Cooper is a director himself.
It's a great story.
And a very good director. And I really think there were scenes in here where it just feels like the two of them were skipping down the lane hand in hand together as they really turned in some great material. It's dark, but also like lush eye candy. I just found it very gripping. I was never bored. My eyes are riveted. There's an extreme amount of tension as it gets towards the end. The payoff's great. I really, really dug this. So I'm going to go ahead and give it 9.5 babies pickled in hard wood alcohol.
Somebody did it.
I'm kind of startled that Del Toro was able to pull back from his more flamboyant instincts, because having seen the original, went, oh, he is going to go hog fucking wild on this film. This plays into all of his favorite things. And he doesn't. He pulls back quite a bit. It's very stylistic. It's very beautiful. But only at moments did I find myself going, this is definitely a Del Toro film. You know, most of it, I'm like, this may be your most restrained work since your Spanish language movies. It's really, really pulled back, as it should be, because a lot of the stuff he does overemphasizes the fable aspects and the unreality of it in his other movies. Like in The Shape of Water, very much plays that up, which isn't a criticism of that film. It just is what it is. Here, he's not really doing that. He wants you to feel the grittiness and the darkness and believe that these are real people. And it works. This is a great adaptation, and I'm happy that a lot of people are finally going to get to see this great film noir story, because it's new and in color and has big name actors that they recognize, and it's Del Toro. Either way, it's a great story and you should see it. And I hope that for some people, this may even be their doorway entry into classic film noir and going like, wow, that was great. I want to see more stuff like this. It's like, oh, we have such sights to show you.
Yes, we do.
There's so many great ones. Yeah, this is a tremendous adaptation of the material. I like a lot of the changes. I can't really say whether I like this better or not than the original. I just saw the original just a few months ago for the first time. And I admit, I kind of wish it had been longer ago, because I was so familiar with it that you know every beat that's going to happen in the story, and you're really like, oh, when something changes, you're like paying more attention to it. And I think in some ways that may have hurt my watching of the film, because I was so balancing it constantly against having seen the original so recently. But that's a unique and interesting perspective in and of itself, I suppose, or way to view the film. I like this a lot, though, and I'm going to give it 9 out of 10 upside down hanged man cards, which that's bad, right?
That means money's coming, Chris.
But I gotta say, as much as I love this movie, I feel like the decision to end it with Bradley Cooper saying, "I feel like chicken tonight, like chicken tonight, like chicken tonight," was in poor taste.
God bless that ending.